every town has its ups and downs. And that's especially true for the little Route 66 town of Erick, Oklahoma, on the far west side of the state, just 7 miles from the Texas border, population just over 1,000. Next week, the Roger Miller Museum will close its doors for good. Opened in 2004, the museum paid tribute to Erick's favorite son.
2 hours of pushing broom buys a 8x12 4-bit room. I'm a man of means by no means.
The legendary singer-songwriter known for number one country hits including King of the Road and Dang Me.
High from the highest tree, woman, would you weep for me?
An entire generation came to know Miller's unique twang as the narrator and musical voice of Disney's 1973 version of Robin Hood. Miller died in 1992. According to a statement from the museum board, quote, all of Roger's memorabilia is on loan to the museum from his wife, Mary Miller, and it will be returned to her and hopefully will be on display somewhere in Nashville at a later date.
Every town has its ups and downs. Some towns' ups outnumber the downs, but not in Nottingham. I'm inclined.
There are many kinds of museums, from the hallowed halls of the Louvre to the humble home of Jesse James, from Tulsa to Tokyo to the Tate Modern. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Movies have been a part of the Philbrook experience for decades. We've shown films on our lawn since the early 1970s, and this year we're showcasing seasonal classics like Elf, Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas, and Die Hard, which easily holds the record for the highest body count in a holiday film.
This is our last show of 2017, and over the holiday break, we'll be catching up on as many movies as we can, from those that take place in a galaxy far, far away, to those so-called prestige pictures, aiming to snag big awards. Today, we're talking movies and more with filmmaker Charles Elmore, host of the Video Drone Tulsa podcast and member of the Oklahoma Film Critics Circle.
So I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about the film season we're in right now. It's 2017. It's the end of the year. Everybody's talking about best of lists and all these different things. But one of the things that comes up a lot at the end of the year, the concept of prestige films, and you hear about the concept of art films, which are saved for the end of the year, for the Oscar season, for the awards season. And you've been involved with criticism and the Oklahoma Film Critics Circle for a while now. Are you seeing a ton of these films? Are you getting inundated with quote-unquote prestige art house films at this time of year?
Yeah, so it's interesting because there's an equal amount of prestige films like, you know, your Shapes of Water and the films that you've been reading about or hearing about since January 2017 that you knew were going to come out around this time or were looking forward to it and kind of watching your clock thinking, like, when are we going to get it? When are we going to get it? Like,
yeah, because they know that they're going to be vying for these awards a year or 2 years out.
Yeah,
you
know,
or I hope know. So, you know, based on what happens at film festivals and things like that.
Yeah, like Adam Chitwood, who he's one of our OFCC members and he writes for Collider, which is a genre films website. He was talking about Call Me By Your Name the week after he got back from Sundance in January.
This is this new film with Armie Hammer, and it's
Timothée Chalamet, and it's about kind of a falling in love, a romance in sort of the sun-bathed Mediterranean.
Italian director who did I Am Love and Bigger Splash and some of these other films.
Which I hadn't seen either of those two, but it's an amazing film. We won't get it here till I think January 15th. So
you watched this on a screener?
Yes.
Is it different watching things on a screener versus do you like to go in the theater? Do you prefer, if you had your preference, would you like to see things ideally in a theater setting?
The short answer is yes. I prefer going to the theater because my attention, I'm of the generation
your
where...
Your phone's going off. And,
yeah, I'm of the generation where going to the theater was a sort of sacred act. It was sort of like you're wrapped, you pay attention, this is important, and you give it your attention, like, and I'm probably somewhat still very aggressive about that. Like, I can't stand people talking during movies. Yeah. Or
you don't want them chewing on their stuff too loudly.
If I had my perfect ideal scenario, I would own my own theater and no one
private
else
screening
come,
room.
But I would have the theater environment. But there are some films that I'm seeing now in this season where I'm actually glad that I don't see them in the theater because they've become somewhat disappointing or it's just not... I would have been disappointed that I paid the full ticket price. And I know that's somewhat disparaging towards the creators of it that I wouldn't pay to see it in the theater, but eventually I would have caught it on Netflix or rented it on iTunes or Amazon or whatever. But, you know, it's a big deal to spend $15 to see a movie that at the end of the day you're going to walk out being like, that wasn't as good as I wanted it to be or whatever. So
at the museum, we have been showing films in different capacities since the early 1970s, really. The museum's been around since, you know, 1939, but in the early 70s, we started showing films out on our lawn. And what's funny is over the years, we've gone through phases where we would show mostly classic films and some art films. I remember years ago, this is such a strange film to show in a on-the-lawn setting. We showed Women in Love, which is a Ken Russell film based on a D.H. Lawrence novel, which famously features a long scene of two men naked wrestling in front of a fireplace. This is Oliver Reed and Alan Bates wrestling. And I remember going to see that, and it just seemed like the idea of watching a film like that in this kind of outdoor setting seemed strange. And we've kind of morphed more into showing more popular films, 80s kind of, you know, favorites and things like The Neverending Story or E.T. or some Wes Anderson film, you know, things that have a broader reach.
Yeah.
But I'm always kind of interested in this concept of art films because it seems like we have this label, which we use somewhat arbitrarily. Independent cinemas are often called art house cinemas. Art films are certain things, but who's to say what is art? So I guess I'd like to start with this. You've seen all these films this year. Have you already kind of started picking your favorites? Do you have a best of list coming soon?
I do. I sort of roughed one out a week or so ago based on a lot of these movies that I already started seeing, plus some of the movies I had seen previous in the year. I try to keep a running list of the movies I see throughout the year just so that I can always go back and remember. And then as I go back, I'll sort of asterisk the ones I liked, and then double asterisks, the ones that I absolutely liked. And then they'll sort of process of elimination, start kind of comparing and contrasting what I liked about them. And so I do have a rough 10 best list ready to go, as well as a sort of honorable mentions. And it's kind of morphing in different places as movies come out, you know? And
it won't be finalized until when? Do you have a certain time when you have to finish it by as part of the OFCC?
For the OFCC, we have, I believe, our deadline to submit our top 10 and our favorites for our voting is December 30th. And I think sometime around the 1st of January, like January 2nd or 3rd, is when we're going to start announcing our kind of OFCC official picks and winners. So because it's a sort of voting body, the sort of final top 10 of the OFCC might not represent
this kind of the collective list, you mean?
Yeah. So my personal 10 best list might vary from the actual final OFCC best of list.
Is it harder to kind of get the bottom five, or like is the top two or three, are those the ones that really kind of stick? And, you know, do you know what your number one is going to be? Like, this is going to be the one unless something amazing comes and bumps it out. And I don't know if you're ready to say what that number one is yet, but do you kind of have a pretty gut instinct as far as, you know, the things that really impact you over the course of a year watching these films?
I know I have a personal number one, and I sort of have number one reserved for sort of two or three different films. And where that, which one will ultimately get it is still kind of up for debate.
But you're
kind of
like, it's going to be probably these three in some order. I don't know yet what the order is.
Yeah, but, and I was actually talking to one of the OFCC members this morning, and we both were like, it's anybody's game, especially for the OFCC specifically, because we've been having this kind of private conversation among the membership of like, pick your favorite actor or favorite performance or favorite film. And it's just the comments are like 20, 30 deep because everyone has a different take on their own favorite movie. So there is no widely contested favorite like there was last year with like Moonlight or Manchester by the Sea or La La Land. It's there are sort of the same five films that people are kind of circling back to as sort of like this is kind of where
like Call Me By Your Name,
Call
for
Me By
example.
Your Name or Get Out or Florida Project. Yeah. But, you know, the sort of friendly, lively debate about the non top three is where it's really interesting because we're sort of defending our own favorites and why we think they should be considered. And then also you have to consider, like, do we, you know, vote with the party line that other film critic circles have been voting? Or is this an opportunity for us to really show our specific voice and viewpoint and, like, pick a film that really spoke to us personally as a voting body and give that an opportunity to highlight it or, you know, shine a light on it, you know?
Yeah.
So
do you see that within a group like that, when you have a bunch of critics all together, obviously you all have personal preferences too. Some probably lean more toward the, quote, maybe more and more entertaining kind of film. Some are more esoteric and pick things that are a little bit more off the radar. Where do you fall in that? Are you kind of more of a mix? At the end of the year, you kind of have a mix of more traditional, maybe big budget films with smaller, quote unquote, art films?
Mine probably would fall more in the esoteric side. I do enjoy the sort of more populist, commercial, critical favorites. But throughout the year, if there's a film that really jumps out at me as amazing, it's going to end up on my list regardless of trying to vote sort of the popular.
Like a film like Get Out was a huge critical success, and it made a lot of money too. So there are those kind of
crossovers.
You know, Dunkirk, for example, big, huge critical success, huge moneymaker. You know, also a big budget, big director film.
Yeah. Dunkirk is like an art house World War II movie because he doesn't care about sound that much to like remix it or ADR it. He cares more about the sort of the story itself, but also sort of the execution and the technique of it, like filming the majority of the movie in IMAX cameras, you know, in like this huge cumbersome camera because it's a beautiful medium and a beautiful frame to look at. But it's a very sort of, you could almost argue like Oscar sort of bait kind of material.
Epic.
Because
it's epic.
It's World War II. It's, you know, a
do you consider that
film
as art? Something that kind of huge, big tent film like that, something that people bank on, the guy who did Batman and all these other films, as compared to something like The Florida Project, which is another acclaimed film with Willem Dafoe, which was filmed in Florida. And it's about people who live in this motel outside of Disney World that kind of lower income and it's kind of through the perspective of children who live there, and Willem Dafoe gives this amazing performance in it. How do you even compare those two? You know, when you're kind of having to say, here's the 10 best films, and judging art is weird to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. I think we could all agree that's very, very difficult.
It's very difficult.
When you have something that's like a Dunkirk, or even Get Out over here, and then you have something like a Florida Project or Call Me By Your Name, they're so different.
Mm-hmm.
It would be difficult for me to even compare and contrast those two without just saying like these are all great, you know.
I would say they're all kind of in the same category in that if you look at the sort of inspiration points or the well that they're drawing from creatively and inspirationally, all kind of come from the same place. Like someone like Christopher Nolan, who chooses to tell a very straightforward story about evacuating British troops from a sort of under siege bay of France. He tells it in a non-linear sort of elliptical way where he's taking three sort of time periods and compressing them into one like 90-minute film without any sort of like hand-holding for the audience. And he might be drawing from influences of French filmmakers who really experimented with linearity and time and storytelling in the 60s and 70s. As opposed to a more traditional formalistic approach like a John Ford film or something.
He's more
like
a kind of a more of a big budget auteur in a certain kind of way.
Yeah, know? And same thing with like Sean Baker in The Florida Project or
like Get Out.
Get Out, yeah. Like I mean Get Out is a whole nother interesting element because, you know, Jordan Peele is pulling not only from commercial film but also his African American filmmaking inspirations where you have filmmakers like
Van Peebles.
Melvin Van Peebles or, you know, Paul Roberson or stuff like that. It's really in the research and preparedness that these filmmakers bring into their work that even if it's a commercial sort of oriented or a populist oriented film, what they're bringing to it is just as important as what they're trying to show or tell you, you know, as opposed to, not to disparage them and people are into this, but the way Michael Bay makes a Transformers film, like he's just there for the shock and awe versus someone like Rian Johnson with The Last Jedi. And you can see literally him quoting films from like Kurosawa and Japanese samurai films of the 60s and 70s, as well as his more commercial inspirations or stuff like that. So Rian Johnson comes from an independent art house world, like with Brick and The Brothers Bloom were sort of character pieces and sort of art house inspired, even though they had their roots in kind of noir films of the 50s and 40s and stuff like that. He just
But now he gets to play in a bigger sandbox.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, same thing with Jordan Peele or even like the Safdie brothers, which going back to my top 10 list, their film Good Time, like that's going to be one of my top five.
This is a film with Robert Pattinson.
Mm-hmm. And Benny Safdie plays his brother.
Yeah.
They kind of rob a bank and then
kind of a heist film mixed with like a techno thriller kind of thing.
Yeah. I kind of described it as Martin Scorsese's After Hours shot in the world of like Mean Streets. So it's just kind of a 24-hour period of just chaos of a guy trying to make fix the mistake he got his own brother into.
Yeah, it was a good film. I liked that
yeah,
one.
But they're going to make their own version of 48 Hours. So
we'll see.
We're all happens. Just remaking our favorite film when we were 15. So.
Well, I think, you know, that's interesting, the idea that we're in a world where we have these super talented people, and especially younger directors, and it seems like they're getting these people who are maybe baby boomer generation who are running studios and mm-hmm. things who grew up on art films of the, you know, the new wave, and they grew up on Fellini, Truffaut, they grew up on that 70s golden age of Hollywood, are seeing these young directors who do maybe one or two cool indies, and then they give them a shot
yeah.
at something. And sometimes that works, and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, the guy who did the last Jurassic Park was an indie filmmaker mm-hmm. who did...
he did Safety Not Guaranteed.
Safety Not Guaranteed, kind of a cool little time travel film.
Yeah.
It was a very small budgeted. But on one hand, I think that's interesting. I think that that's kind of a cool place to be. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, would I rather see them continue making original work that's really going to come out of left field mm-hmm. as opposed to like their take on whatever big franchise?
Yeah.
You know, does that help the kind of artistic vision in the long term? I'm not totally sure about that. What's your thoughts on that?
I think honestly, it kind of hinders the future and the forward momentum of, if not independent filmmaking, certainly kind of adult-driven, dramatic filmmaking. Like, I've had this conversation with friends in the past about this specific topic, because you see filmmakers like Colin Trevorrow or even, you know, Jordan Vaught Roberts, and most notably the biggest sort of pariah of this kind of specific conversation is someone like Josh Trank, who he made a very high-concept, commercial-driven indie film about three kids that discover a meteor and they get superpowers. And it was sort of a found footage thing, but it got him success enough to direct the reboot of Fantastic Four.
Huge bomb.
And stories of his sort of, you know, mental breakdown were running around. And at one point he was attached to direct one of the Star Wars spinoffs, but because of all this controversy about his behavior and his, whether he can hack it, he basically got kicked out of the system. And, you know, if you look at that and if you think back to like the 70s and 80s, like imagine if like Martin Scorsese had made Who's That Knocking at My Door and then Mean Streets. And then all of a sudden they call and say, hey, can you direct this film?
Poseidon Adventure 2.
Poseidon Adventure 2. And he goes on to make all these, you know, questionably contributional works of cinema. We get robbed of
that are kind of like a more interesting version of something we already know, as opposed to something brand new, which is
yeah.
what I'm always looking for. I want to see something brand new, something that just knocks me out.
Yeah, like I would much rather, and I say this very lightly because I'm hit or miss on actually liking him, but the news that Quentin Tarantino is going to write, he had a great idea for a new Star Trek, and that, you know, the whole world lit up about what could a Quentin Tarantino Star Trek look like. I don't care. Like, it's bad enough that I always go into a Quentin Tarantino movie debating whether or not I want to see a Quentin Tarantino movie, that to lose the potential of seeing a true Quentin Tarantino movie because he gets plucked out and put in the driver's seat of an intellectual property series that's...
You want to see the next new thing from his brain.
Yeah, I mean, I want to see these individual artists keep
more than
creating.
Spock cursing, you know.
Yeah, like, I don't want to hear, what do they call a quarter pounder with cheese and the...
Klingon.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, a good example of that would be talking about Star Wars. There's a famous story, people know this story, that David Lynch almost directed Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, imagine a world where you didn't have the newest Twin Peaks, you know, series, or, you know, you didn't have Mulholland Drive or Lost Highway. Like,
He did that, and it takes him on some weird path where he's doing stuff like that.
I mean, Dune is like kind of the closest sort of like branched, split, alternate reality where you get the best of both worlds, and even that film is really.
And you could argue that that was his biggest mistake of his whole career, probably doing that.
And it kind of rebooted him into pursuing the thing that he loves to do, which is these, you know, weird.
Do you watch a lot of TV? Or are you kind of still stuck in the more? Do you know, because there's this huge crossover now where they say most of the true, you know, artisan stuff is happening in the world of television and these limited series more so than film. Are you kind of in both places? Are you watching like the new Twin Peaks? Do you watch Godless or some of these limited series on Netflix or any of the different formats?
I do as often as I can when I finish one of them. First, it's just impossible to keep up with the sheer volume of material out there, and everyone's got a different take or a different sort of favorite show. And every time someone's like, "Oh, you got to check this out," it's like adding that to the list, and it's just this perpetually
ongoing list,
increasing
never
list. And then there's the stuff that I specifically want to seek out. Like the show that I hands down waited for everything to see was Mindhunter. And of course, I've watched it probably 3 or 4 times
all the way through.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've watched it. I watched the whole thing. This is a show that David Fincher of Seven, Zodiac,
someone who will himself refuse the auteur theory and has gone on record for saying he doesn't believe in it, which I agree with.
Who has famously once, I believe, jumped into a franchise, which was the Alien franchise way back when, before he kind of made a name for himself.
And it burnt him on
and
it.
Didn't have a good experience with. Yeah, and that's an interesting moment because I would consider him to be one of those people who crosses over to where I can see a film of his, I can see a TV show of his and see him in it or his style through it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a great point. That show was a powerful show for me, and I thought it was, you know, as good as anything I've seen this year, and as maybe as good as any film I saw this year as a whole. Now, of course, they had, 10 hours or whatever it was to do, and there's just different things you can do with that. But in terms of the quality of it, the look of it, the sound of it, it's up there with the highest quality films that are out there. So maybe we shouldn't think of them too differently now.
Well, I think they should be treated differently in the sense that you can do things a lot differently with a sort of short form serialized show or a Netflix show or Amazon than you can in film. And what hopefully will happen is instead of sort of trying to sort of compare them and say that this golden age of TV is the new cinema, is that what's happening in TV becomes its own sort of category of narrative storytelling, and film still stays what it is, or narrative film stays what it is, which maybe emboldens filmmakers to really focus on what they can do in an hour and a half or 2 hour time frame, as opposed to saying that TV is taking over from or getting better than movies. What is interesting is how these type of TV shows are attracting filmmakers who really want to not have the arduous conflicts that are occurring in sort of studio driven filmmaking or you know, mid-range $30-50 million budgets type of films where you got to hit a certain amount of kind of approval ratings or safety nets that don't, you know, you got to hit the four quadrants, so to speak. Whereas in a show like Mindhunter or Godless, like you can meander and spend a whole episode on one character.
Yeah, digressions are fine.
Yeah, it's
The Leftovers was like that. I don't know if you watched that, but that was a truly kind of cinematic.
Yeah, that's when I kind of gave up on after
cinematic
the first season.
Cinematic journey. Yeah.
But like, I hate to sort of be reductive in this sense, but you can be more novellic in visual storytelling and make it entertaining, as opposed to prior to The Sopranos, where it was just sort of episodic. Each episode was contained within itself. I think the new sort of form of TV, or you say TV, and it's kind of, you're not even counting unless it's a really good exceptional show like a Justified or something like that. But broadcast TV or syndicated TV or cable TV is just, it's not even operating on the same sphere. Even a show like Game of Thrones, like I don't know anyone who really watches it like on HBO, like through their cable provider versus like just on their DVR or through their HBO Now subscription.
Certainly not watching it when it comes on at, you know, 8 o'clock on a Sunday night. They're catching up on it at some point, whenever they can, basically.
Yeah.
Even if it's like at 9 o'clock that night.
This episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by 100% Egyptian cotton white art handling gloves, suitable for touching all types of delicate objects and sensitive surfaces. Not only is it just plain wrong to handle art without gloves, it's illegal in 12 states, also available in off-white for a limited time only. One size fits most.
The National Film Registry just announced some films that it's adding to its list of films that it's kind of preserving. They preserve these films, and they announce, I guess, every year a new list of films that they're doing. One of the ones that I thought was kind of interesting that was on this year's list was Die Hard. And we're showing Die Hard at the museum during our holiday celebration. It has become kind of this great alternate holiday film, certainly the one with the highest body count probably of all holiday films. But I thought it was kind of interesting that that's a film that's been out for 30-odd years and is super fun and uber violent and all these things, but it's kind of crossed over into this place where it really is viewed as this kind of classic.
So
is time a factor in how films are perceived overall? I mean, that's, you know, on this list with the great films of all time now.
Yeah. I mean, I think the more people see something and the more frequency of revisiting it and reanalyzing it and rediscovering it contributes heavily to the popularity and the impact of a film. I mean, I'm sure there are other movies from that same decade or same year specifically, but Die Hard's the one that it's the sort of stake in the ground of like what that time period was like or what action movies were at that time. And just the fact that it's highly enjoyable, it's
very quotable.
It's very quotable. It gave us Bruce Willis as a celebrity and action hero, and it kind of modernized the sort of bedraggled, weary, dragged into a situation that he wasn't wanting kind of hero that sort of defined every action movie afterwards.
Yeah. It's like Die Hard on a train, Hard in a plane, Die
exactly.
Hard in this.
You know, and really it's just they're just putting on new clothes on the old sort of gumshoe detective
me against
PI
the world
kind of
thing.
Trope of the 40s and 50s of noir films where it's just some, you know, it's Fred McMurray being dragged into a situation that he's not prepared for and kind of treading
not
water.
Quite an anti-hero, but kind of in that sarcastic thing where it's also kind of like reluctant hero somewhat too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Kind of like wrong place, wrong time, still have to deal with the situation. Yeah, it's certainly, you see that everywhere.
And plus I think everyone from like our generation and either, you know, a few years on either side, like we're in the place of sort of being able to dictate what we think is good or what is classical and important. And so we get to pass down the fact that we saw this movie when we were kids and continue to see it throughout life and that it was just this amazing action film that, you know,
well, it's ultimately what's subjective
about seeing,
you know?
Films.
I mean, we get to decide what's art, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing, you know, whatever we think is valuable and whatever we think is, you know, generational part of that and all these different things. So 2017 is wrapping up. It's the end of 2017. You've seen all these films. You've watched these shows. Is there one thing you've seen, whether it's one episode of a show or one film or one scene of a film that kind of haunts you from this year? That's something that you just haven't been able to shake? Because I usually judge things on whether they stick with me or not. If I see something and I enjoy it and then I come out of theater, but by the next week I don't even think about it again, I kind of think it must not have been that impactful. But if I'm thinking about it or I feel the need to revisit it, to me personally, that's how I start to build up whether I think something is of value or not. But is there something that kind of blew your mind this year?
Yeah. Good Time is definitely one of the ones that blew my mind. It's just a really well-executed, gritty kind of film. Killing of a Sacred Deer is another one that just has set with me since I saw it.
This is a film directed by the guy who did The Lobster, which was a big film.
And
Colin Farrell, Nicole Kidman.
Yeah, and it's just such a bizarrely executed film. It's a pretty straightforward film. It's you know, a cardio surgeon sort of loses a patient, and then the son of that patient visits this guy's life, and then tragedy starts to befall him, and it becomes this existential dilemma of making a choice that leads to sort of tragedy, but also sort of
it was weird.
Reparation. Yeah,
but great. I liked it.
Great. Yeah, absolutely. And the score was amazing. It's someone described it as Kubrickian, and you can really see that kind of.
I haven't forgotten
DNA.
It. I've remembered everything about it. I thought about it the next day and the day after that.
Yeah, but one of the films, and I put this on this list only because I haven't seen it since I saw it in the theater, but I've thought about it pretty frequently since I saw it, I think, around the first of the year, and that's James Gray's Lost City of Z. I know some of, you know, my contemporaries have dismissed it or don't necessarily like its sort of imperialistic sort of bent, but I feel like I had a different sort of experience with it. But just from a visual standpoint and from a just a sort of Odyssey kind of storytelling, it's just the thing that really blew me away this year.
Yeah, you this know? Is based on a book by David Grann from The New Yorker about a guy named Percy Fawcett, who was an explorer who went to South America looking for this mythical city of Zed, which they call it Zed. Yeah. And I like that film. It kind of felt like a classic film from an era that we don't really see anymore. It felt like a film they don't make that kind of film
Which is
anymore.
Why I think I liked it so much, is that the texture and the graininess of the cinematography and the sort of formalism of it would just really hit me in the exact right spot. Plus, I'm a huge James Gray fan, and I know he's hot and cold for a lot of people. And, you know, sometimes his formalism gets a little too boring for some, but I just think...
Yeah, he's great. He's Anybody one of the, listening he's one of our to this, best American go find The Immigrant, go find The Yards, go find We Own the Night.
We Own the Night, which people would say is like really just boring procedural cop drama. Like he manages to put it in his own sort of spin. And
a lot of these films have Joaquin Phoenix in them.
Yes.
He's great. Yeah. If you like his films, you'll probably like all his films.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that's interesting. So people need to go see Lost City of Z. It's out. They can rent it.
It's
they
on
can
Amazon.
Watch it online. They can Prime. They can do everything they want.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, thank you for being with us today.
Absolutely.
We look forward to hearing the best of list.
January 2nd is when we start announcing the winners. And we kind of, last year, they did this new rollout sort of announcement where just sort of every 20, 30 minutes on Twitter, we would announce the winners. And so we're going to do something similar this year where we'll kind of roll them out one by one and announce as we go along.
January 2nd.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
As we often say, there are many kinds of museums. One example is an unassuming 19th century Victorian home in Cleveland. This museum is open 7 days a week. Aside from daily tours, guests can also stay overnight. The house can accommodate up to 6 guests. For many years, the house had fallen into disrepair. In 2004, an entrepreneur from San Diego named Brian Jones bought the house on eBay for $150,000. For the down payment, Jones used profits from his business, the Red Rider Leg Lamp Company, spending $240,000 to gut the structure, reconfiguring it to a single-family dwelling, transforming it into a near replica of how it looked in his favorite film, the 1983 holiday classic, A Christmas Story. The house and museum opened to the public in late 2006, with original cast members attending the big celebration. There were no reports of any tongue or BB gun injuries. If you make it to Cleveland, check it out. Just look for the leg in the window.
Ah, there it is. The holy grail of Christmas gifts, the Red Rider 200-shot range model air rifle.
Ralphie, what would you like for Christmas?
That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.